Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now, my co-mates and brothers in exile, hath not old custom made this life more sweet than that of painted pomp? Are not these woods more free from peril than the envious court? Here feel we not the penalty of Adam, the season's difference, as the icy fang and churlish chiding of the winter's wind, which when it bites and blows upon my body even till I shrink with cold. I smile and say, this is no flattery. These are counsellors that feelingly persuade me what I am. Sweet are the uses of adversity.
That was the Duke to his men in the Forest of Arden in Act Two of As You Like It. Welcome back to The Play's the Thing. I am Tim McIntosh, and I am joined, hello Heidi, by Heidi White.
Hi,
how
Tim.
How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Here we are. It's the end of days, so.
Yeah. It's the end of days. So let's talk about, you and I, before we started recording, thought it might be kind of fun to just narrate what our existence is like on, what is it, like maybe like the end of the first week of the coronavirus protection measures. I'm not quite sure how we're going to call it. I think by the time that we release all five acts of As You Like It, this recording will be, I don't know, maybe a 3 weeks to 5 weeks out of date. So we thought it might be kind of a fun time capsule, presuming we're both alive, Heidi, and all of our loved ones are alive. It might be a nice kind of time capsule to talk about what is going on in our lives during this bizarre time.
It is so strange. It's
yeah,
just
it really is.
So surreal. And we talked about this when we recorded Crime and Punishment for our listeners who are listening along, where Crime and Punishment recording, we talked about the response and our own situations, and it's been a week since then.
Yeah.
So that, you know, chronological time is tricky with all these different recordings that we do, but we are in Colorado. I am in Colorado. You are not in Colorado anymore.
Right?
Because you were the last time we talked.
Yeah, that's right.
You were traveling back from Colorado. So anyway, we just had a huge blizzard yesterday, and like right in the middle of basically the quarantine, the stay home if you can. And so we are, not only do we need extra food and toilet paper, if you can find any of those things for social distancing purposes, but we're also just snowed in. So it is just a strange time.
Part of this act of As You Like It, there's a strong emphasis on this kind of notion that if we can pull back from the city, mm-hmm. and away from the court's corrupting influences, its jealousies, its envies. There's something ennobling about the forest. So our play has shifted from the court to the forest. All of our main characters have gotten kicked out of the court, and now they're kind of dispersed through the forest and they're wandering here and there, and they're soon going to all kind of gradually join up. That speech that we heard at the top of the recording really emphasizes how much, you know, we can be free if we can get away from the pomp and falsities of the court. And I'm wondering, Heidi, are we in a similar situation now? You know, like, what would Shakespeare say about the situation that we're in? We're kind of, you know, to some degree self-quarantined, at least in Seattle. All the restaurants are closed down. All the bars are closed down. All the schools are closed down. So like these meeting places where we would go and gather are deemed dangerous enough that they're closed down.
Right.
Do you think Shakespeare is saying, well, yeah, that's a step in the right direction? Or is that a really different sort of situation than his characters are experiencing in the Forest of Arden?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, human nature being what he is, being what it is, Shakespeare does have something to say about that. In fact, he himself was quarantined during a plague outbreak in London.
Yeah.
And he wrote King Lear. So that was, he used his time wisely.
Yeah, he did.
For those of us who are binge watching The Office. but yeah, I think this idea, especially in Elizabethan England, in which court intrigue was, I mean, you're risking your life.
Mm-hmm.
There's people's heads being cut off. Our pets' heads are falling off. Did you catch that reference from Dumb and Dumber?
No.
But yeah, this idea of the removal of like voluntary or involuntary removal into the natural world, or what Shakespearean scholars call the green world, from the corrupting influence of what he might claim isn't truly civilized society, right? There's this conflict between, as you pointed out, the corrupting influence of the courts, and then the ennobling influence of the natural world. And he definitely explores that in As You Like It. And I think there's something to be said for that. But what I really like about this particular play, and what I love about Shakespeare in general, is he never lets anything be so simplistic. So he is drawing the parallel between, the contrast between, not the parallels, he's contrasting the court and the green world. But at the same time, he doesn't let the green world be an Eden, right? It's not perfect. He even draws attention to that in Act Two, Scene One, when Duke Senior talks about how the green world, the Forest of Arden, still has the cold winter winds and they're killing deer, and that's sad. And so he still lets it be a place that's truly human, which I like that.
Yeah.
And I feel that being stuck in the green world right now, it's not Eden. So
you're experiencing the icy fang and churlish chiding of the winter's wind.
There you go. Yep.
He does. Nature bites back, even in the green world. And
right.
I think this is part of its ennobling influence, is that it's not, as you just said, an Eden, but it's a place of, it's a beautiful place. It's a somewhat welcoming place, but more than anything else, it's a place that has the ability to provide something like an authentic trial,
right,
as opposed to the inauthentic trial of, you know, all these petty back and forths of the court. And all of us have experienced this in one way or another. Human society, and I'm as guilty as anybody, is full of territory squabbles and easily hurt feelings and hierarchies that want to be preserved and others want to tear them down. And there is something about going away from that, which is in some ways sort of cleansing. Hmm. And part of it, I think Shakespeare is saying, part of it is the forest is, it's not always an easy place. I think we'd be wrong to read the Forest of Arden as merely a place of beautiful repose. No, it's a place that actually stings and bites and provides adversity.
Right. Right. I agree completely. And I, oh man, we talk about this with Shakespeare all the time. I feel like a little bit of a broken record, but I think that one thing that Shakespeare never does is idealizes a place. We did, you know, before we recorded this one, we recorded The Tempest, and he doesn't idealize the island. It has, as you point out, plenty of adversity along with it, but it's the kind of adversity that, that provides an opportunity for characters to go through some kind of trial and disorder and to come back into order. As you said, it provides a purifying kind of adversity rather than one that is going to break down these characters. It's going to build them up.
Yeah. Okay. Disorder and a return to order. Heidi, I want to ask you something.
And I'm seeing so many parallels in our modern time. I want to come back to that. So, but I'm going to go back.
Well, no, let's go there now. Let's go there now. What are the parallels that you're thinking of in our modern time?
Oh, man, just this virus and how much the response that I see in myself and in my community and on social media this is revealing the disorders within our society, like our addictions to entertainment and the easy life, right? Like even last night I was having a conversation with the Scott White about how, and he was saying, it's just, like, it sounds so silly, but this is modernity, right? Like it's hard to not have like an NBA game to flip on at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And that's part of that is what something like this reveals are the fault lines, the cracks within a society. And we have the opportunity to then become a mending or a healing force to those things in our own souls and in the larger world, or to, you know, throw up our hands and complain and live in fear and wait for the government to fix it and you know, become then part of the disordering force of society. But it's adversity that reveals those fault lines and those cracks in real life as well as in stories. And I see that in this play.
Yeah. I had a couple conversations yesterday. One of them was with my sister and another one was with a friend of mine who is a nurse at a large clinic in Atlanta, and she has two little girls and she has older parents. So I'm just going to set this scene because this is the first time that I started getting really nervous about the virus. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm ignorant about the possibilities of my loved ones getting sick or me getting sick, or like the thing that I worry about more than anything else is probably like passing it along unwittingly to somebody because I've not been careful. So my friend is presumably going to be in contact with Corona victims through her clinic. There are none yet, but the expectation is this is just going to happen. Her girls are, 8 and 6. So she could send her girls to her parents who have, you know, said, we want to take care of them. But that might mean that she has no access to her girls for right. as long as this thing lasts. Because if she has, you know, if she's kind of spending a lot of time in virus riddled places,
right,
she could potentially transfer it to her daughters. And though her daughters might not be ill, because it doesn't seem like that's where the virus is hitting, they could be transfers to her parents. And she's feeling terrible that, oh my gosh, if she was responsible for her parents getting ill in their old age. And I just thought, oh goodness, there is no good solution for her. The other solution is her clinic has said, if you want to bring your girls to the clinic, we will have a place where they can stay and play, and they'll be out of harm's way. You know, they'll be kept safe and they won't be trafficking the virus, et cetera, et cetera. But still, that was, you know, it's this, there is no good solution. And she's hearing these rumors. I won't even repeat the rumors because they're, I don't know that they're confirmed. But being in that industry, she's hearing rumors that make her nervous and make sure. Her afraid that, like, oh gosh, this might not be contained. So I know for myself, I am trying to find this way of being really attuned to what the truth is about the way I should comport myself in public. And what sort of things I need to do to kind of protect myself and other people. But I also, to get that information, it's you kind of walk this fine line of you could go down the rabbit hole and read all of the rumors and all of the speculations in an effort to keep yourself safe, and you would never come out of your closet again.
Right. Right. No, it's true. Well, and that, to your point, I mean, the first thing I thought of when you said that was the Chronicles of Narnia. It was the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, because those children are sent out of London into the country to go see mm-hmm. the professor because there's a threat to the society through the bombings in London. And so Lewis is using the same trope as Shakespeare is here, that there's a sickness, there's a threat within the larger world, within the civilized world. And the only way to mend that threat in the lives of individuals is they have to at some point be removed from it and experience an entry into another world, access to another world. And in that world, whether it's magical or not, it is in Midsummer Night's Dream, it is in The Tempest, but it's not in As You Like It. The green world is just it has kind of a magical feel to it, but really it doesn't have any magic in it. It is a removal. It's a place of wonder, a place of renewal, a place in which the seasons perform kind of their healing work on the souls of these people who have been wounded by the broken world. And that's a very Christian idea.
Mm.
And that there is a sickness in the fallen world that can be mended and made right in another world.
Yeah.
But I like what Shakespeare does, is he makes it very human.
Yeah, very.
And he makes it a place in which there's plenty of adversity, there's plenty of disorder, there's plenty to be made right there, as well as in the civilized world. And then at the end of this play, and this is giving something away, so I'm sorry, everybody goes back.
Mm-hmm.
But they bring the healing with them.
Mm.
And that goes back to the pastoral tradition in a literary sense. And I think I think that's a very Christian idea. There's a sweetness to that idea.
Yeah, there is, for sure. Disordering. The word has come up a few times already in our conversation. Heidi, this play centers around one key couple.
Mm.
And this couple they met at the beginning, Orlando and Rosalind, and now they're kind of separated from each other. They don't know really that each other loves. How do you say that? They have not revealed their love to each other.
Right, right.
But this is a comedy. And so often Shakespeare's comedies, if not all the time, are center around a match. that a match that is being thwarted, but by the end of the comedy, the match happens, the couple gets together, and usually there's a wedding ceremony. Mm-hmm. But along the way, the effects of love, of romantic love upon the couple, Shakespeare describes it, you mentioned this off the air, it seems like it is both a disordering effect and an ordering effect, romantic love. This is your observation off the air. And I think
I'm so wise.
You are so wise. You are so wise. No, it's exactly right.
Yeah, that definitely plays out here. This is in, I think, every Shakespearean comedy, some more dark than others. And in this play, it is very lighthearted in As You Like It. Maybe one of the most lighthearted treatments of love in Shakespeare, I think, while also being very profound at the same time. Mm-hmm. There's never a sense I get in As You Like It. I really just don't ever get a sense that that there's some kind of real danger to these people. That I realize that Oliver is out to get Orlando. I get that.
Right.
But it doesn't feel dark. You know, some of Shakespeare's other comedies really have a melancholy to them. Even at like Twelfth Night has this thread of melancholy and
yes.
Like you can't, and Merchant of Venice is like that too. Like you can't get away from the sadness even as you're tracing the thread of redemption in the story. But As You Like It is different to me. I think it's very lighthearted throughout. And I don't take any of the threats very seriously, but it still is very disordered in the sense that you're like, it gets really complicated and you don't know how they're going to sort it all out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And act two is a long act. That's what we're talking about today. And it has all of these threads that are getting tangled up throughout the act. He's presenting all of these different threads of disorder and they're all kind of getting really entangled as we go. And that's pretty normal in the trajectory of a Shakespearean play. It gets the acts one and two kind of give you this mounting sense of disorder. And you're like, how are they going to get out of this one? How are these lovers ever going to get together?
Right,
how are
right.
they going to, and then it kind of peaks in act three and then detangles, and weaves together to form something in acts four and five. And that is a very common trajectory in Shakespearean plays, and that's just in stark relief in this one. But we have a lot of mistaken identities in this play. And that's common in pastoral tradition. I'll stick to a literary thread here for a minute. The pastoral tradition comes from ancient Greek comedies, and in which the characters would leave the city because of some kind of threat to their young love, and mostly because of fathers who refuse to let people get together.
Yeah.
And we see that in Shakespeare over and over again, but it comes from Greek comedy. This idea that there's this older generation that is holding back the younger generation from being able to be together because of some kind of empty tradition or ambition on the part of the father. And he wants his highborn daughter to marry his jerky highborn neighbor's kid so that they can join the family estates together. But
Romeo and Juliet.
Yes, but exactly. But the younger generation, you know, usually it's a highborn lady has fallen in love with a lowborn man. And he's a farmer. And so she goes out there disguised and they get to or something like that. So that's the pastoral tradition. And in rejecting the city state, which is literally a walled city in Greece, in ancient Greece, and leaving the walled contained city state that's literally dirty as well as morally corrupt and going out into the pastoral landscape where they're growing grapes and drinking wine and it's warm all the time and it just feels free and happy. And then they have these disguised identities and then somehow along the way they disentangle the obstacles, they remove the obstacles to their love and they get to get married. And then the father finds out that the young shepherd boy was actually a prince in disguise the whole time. And then they're welcomed back into the city. And that's a traditional Greek comedy in the pastoral tradition. And Shakespeare borrows that in a number of his plays, particularly in this one, kind of pokes fun at it as well as using it to explore some pretty profound ideas about love and order.
Romeo and Juliet, to keep up with the theme, they meet for the first time at a masked ball and they kind of reveal each other to themselves. But they also kind of like recognize, at least for this time being, they have to keep their masks on because they are from opposite families, families that are at war. I want to go back, Heidi, to romantic love as both disordering and ordering. And I want to ask you, why does it have that kind of dual effect? But I want to skip ahead and read a section from this famous scene where Rosalind and Orlando meet. So they meet in the forest a couple acts from now. And Rosalind is, per your description, she is disguised. She's disguised as a man. So she's giving Orlando, who is completely love struck with her, but doesn't know who she is because she's disguised. Rosalind is giving him advice on how to court. But she also kind of goes into this description of the effects of love. And I want to read a little bit of it. Rosalind says, "Love is merely a madness. And I tell you, deserves as well a dark house and a whip as madmen do. And the reason why they are not so punished and cured is that the lunacy is so ordinary that the whippers are in love too." So there's this sense like there's this kind of contagiousness. Love is a madness that is so contagious that even the people who try to drive it out become infected.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about this, and I completely resonate with what you said, that romantic love in Shakespeare, it's almost a hurricane, and so it disorders, but there is something ordering about it because it is the path toward marriage, and marriage in the comedies, so often, it is the solution not just to lovesickness, but it's a bigger solution. It's a harmonizing solution that brings couples together, that brings families together, that reorganizes towns, cities that have fallen into some sort of disharmony because of, let's say, Romeo and Juliet warring factions, or maybe like Measure for Measure, there's an overly stringent ruler who's like suppressing. So let's talk about it. I want to hear what you think. Why does romantic love both bring disorder and order?
Yeah, it is really interesting, the paradoxes of that. So in this particular play, Rosalind is in good standing at court in Act One, and so is Celia. And because they fall in love, they are cast out. They actually decide to leave because the love that they fall into, and I'll talk about that in a second, is a threat to the existing social order. And so in that sense, it's a disordering force. It's disordering to their own lives because then they have to make a choice, right? They have to choose a path. Am I going to follow this love that has happened to me? I'm a passive victim of it in a way. Or am I going to deny my desire for this person and do what is conceived of by my elders, usually the overbearing father figure of some kind. In this case, it's the corrupt Duke Frederick. And am I going to follow what he tells me is my duty? So it's this constant choice between duty and desire in every Shakespearean comedy. Love is presented as desire, and the social order is presented as duty. And the Elizabethan audience would have absolutely recognized the social order as a moral duty.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that Americans, the individualistic American,
a little tougher for us.
Yes, like we don't quite understand that. We're always on the side of the young lovers because they're in love, and we are entirely a society driven by our desire. That is the higher force. That's not the case in Elizabethan England, in that hierarchy of Elizabethan life, and actually in most of human history.
Yeah,
the social order is the duty. And so, rightly so, in their eyes. And so, to be a lover is to be overcome, as Shakespeare says over and over again in this play and in others, by a kind of madness
mm-hmm.
that is profoundly disorienting to the individual because of how much of a threat it is to everything they've ever been raised to love and to recognize as their duty.
Yeah.
And to recognize as God's moral order. You were born a highborn person, Rosalind, because God wanted you to be, because that's where you were placed
mm-hmm.
in society. So to mm-hmm. throw that over for the sake of a feeling for a younger brother, just because he is really good in a wrestling match, like to Americans, we're like, yeah, you go, girl, but not to Elizabethans.
Right.
So it is a disordering force in her life and in the society in which she is a functioning member. But Shakespeare's more subtle than that. He actually then throughout the play, even though it's a comedy and it's hilarious and there's all these hijinks and funny speeches and characters, what he's really saying is desire and duty can be brought together.
Yeah.
And that's the course of the redeeming aspect of the play. By the end of
that's
the play,
that's the harmonizing effect of romantic love.
That's exactly right. By the end of the play, it's Rosalind and Orlando's love that takes place in the green world, that develops there in a very funny context. It is their love that then harmonizes the duty and desire, not only of themselves, but of their society, and creates a new and more healed society.
So yeah.
That everybody has a new place and a new duty and a new role. And then they bring that back to the civilized world, thus healing the corrupt city as well as themselves.
Yeah. Heidi, I'm going to go on a couple of tangents. The first one, I think what you said about United States, our vision of ourselves is very individualistic. And I kind of wonder if the virus is going to put that, at least for the time being, to the test. And what I mean is this, that the World Health Organization has, I think last week, singled out a couple of countries for doing a very good job at containing the virus. And those two countries were China and South Korea. But if you look at the way in which they did, at least China, contain the virus, it was very stringent. Mm-hmm. So if you lived in an apartment complex, you had to get swabbed upon re-entering. If you left for groceries, you had to get swabbed and tested upon re-entering. And there are all sorts of methods that we might call, you know, draconian,
right,
that the Chinese utilize to flatten their curve, their outbreak curve. And I heard a commentator say, gosh, if it came to that, would we go along with it? Like if the authorities in our country said, yeah, it's gotten to that point now that we need to take stringent measures like the Chinese did. China is a much more autocratic society than ours is. And so I was thinking, okay, would we go along with it? And my thought was, I think the biggest reason why we would object is not in action, but in we would have a major epistemic obstacle to doing something like that. And and what I mean is, with an autocratic society, there is kind of gravity to believe in the authorities of the state, partly because you get punished if you don't. Mm-hmm. In the United States, I think part of what is difficult about, what is going to be difficult about managing the virus is, well, who do you believe? Who do you believe? We don't have an autocratic state. And so every person to some degree is a king unto himself, a queen unto herself. And that means there's a strong inclination to kind of question, you know, to ask the question, says who? Is right. this really viable information? Whereas in a more autocratic society, pushing back against asking the question who says does not benefit you at all. It's easier just to go along with it.
Right. Right.
So that's the thing that I kind of worry about for the United States is if there really is, if the curve continues to expand, do we have the ability not just to unify in action, but to take the step before action, which is, can we unify about the legitimacy of the threat, acknowledge it, and then take action accordingly?
Right. Yes, I agree. There is a sense in the American mind of you can't tell me what to do, and I'm an exception to the rules that apply to everybody else, but not to me. And I think we don't know that about ourselves. And I think that's one of the things that literature does, is that it allows us to kind of create, to displace ourselves from our own circumstances and look at the circumstances of a different time, a different way of thinking, a different perspective on the world, and to enter into that. And from that perspective, then to look back at ourselves. And that's what Lewis argues in On the Reading of Old Books, which is an introduction to St. Athanasius's On the Incarnation. And it's a masterpiece in itself, that introduction. And I think that's part of what we attempt to do when we read old books like Shakespeare. We enter into that and we look at, like, even just this conversation, I'm reading As You Like It differently, saying, in some ways, I'm in a green world right now. How can I acknowledge my disorder and reorder it to a new society?
Yeah.
And within myself, within my family, within my community. And I you're right. A national crisis, it exposes the cracks and the fault lines in each individual soul and also in the soul of that nation and society. And that's what Shakespeare does. That's like his thing.
Yeah.
In every play, it's that. It's, let's look at the fault lines in this character, and then let's look at the fault lines in this society. Let's look at how profoundly unfair primogeniture is. Mm. That Oliver, who is a jerk, like a morally corrupt, greedy individual, he has access to all of the wealth of his family and has withheld it from his worthy younger brother, Orlando, who does not have the education of a gentleman and is forced then to live like a peasant and is healed by the love of a good woman who's been banished from her society even for no good reason.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, that Shakespeare explores that. And we, I think, in a crisis like this, can find ourselves in these books. And I'm so interested and intrigued by the fact that right now people are reading plague literature and watching plague films.
Uh-huh.
I just think that's like fascinating.
Oh, I do too. I do too. I mean, I think it's got to be. I have been wanting to go back and read Camus' The Plague, which I used to teach at Gutenberg. Mm-hmm. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that Camus lived through an outbreak like the one, much more severe than the one that we're living through when he was in France. This would have been after World War II. I hope I remember that correctly. But I'm just curious. That book is it's a very bleak book, but I've been curious to go back and read it just to read did it feel to him the way it feels to me? Does it feel different? What is it, you know, like what are the similarities and what are the dissimilarities? And I think, I mean, this is why we read literature, why we read movies. There's an attempt to kind of like understand someone in circumstances similar to our own, in the hopes that we can sort of, like children, pretend our way into solutions. What would I do in this situation? Would I be a good person? Would I be a bad person? Would I be the hero? Would I be the villain?
Trying to come into the city. This is Camus' question. We're all going to shut the gates. That's the conclusion he comes to. And you hope that that's not true. But that's what happens in the city. Everyone's left out.
Heidi, is it easier just to adopt a pose like Jacques adopts? I mean, isn't he? He is such a curious character.
Yes.
Let me just give you my impression of Jacques, like to hear what your impression of Jacques is. He is socially unbonded. So he's hanging out with these guys in the Forest of Arden, but he's not really linked to them in any way, if that makes any sort of sense. They like to laugh at him. They think he's profound at times, and indeed he's very profound. But there's not an affection for him that the Lord has for, the Duke Senior has for his other men. It's more like Jacques is kind of almost a court jester in some way, but a court jester that doesn't have the sort of acute moral sense than the clown does in Lear, as a contrast. And Jacques is so jaded. He's such a cynical character. I find myself disliking him for all of his profundity. I find myself not enjoying his company very much.
Yeah.
What are your impressions?
I totally agree. I think that Jacques is like, so to your point, he's fascinating because there's a long tradition of Shakespearean analyst scholars or whatever who think of him as a failed character, but I don't. Their reasons are because his melancholy never really transcends itself into profundity. And I think that's true, but I think that's intentional on Shakespeare's part. And I think it's really cool. I like that about him. It's different from some of the other melancholy or sad characters in Shakespearean comedy. Malvolio in Twelfth Night comes to mind. He's an incredibly sad and profound and broken Caliban and Shylock. Jacques is not a villain. He's just kind of this melancholy presence in the green world. And if you want to allegorize it to the soul, he's like the part of us that can never be made happy no matter how good things are, right? And and is always just kind of grumpy about everything all the time and wants to make that into some kind of profundity, but it just ends up being just like silly melancholy, melodrama.
Yeah.
And Touchstone, on the other hand, is entirely nihilistic, but he actually has some kind of moral weight to him, whereas Jacques is just kind of silly and almost like adolescent. And is like, you know, you kind of get the feeling
a little bit petulant.
Yes, like he doesn't have any kind of real any kind of really truly profound grief. There's no grief to him. He's just grumpy.
Yeah.
He's just like mad all the time and finds problems with everything.
Yeah.
And doesn't like anything. There's a really funny, this is giving something away from the next time we talk, but there's a really funny scene when he tells Orlando he doesn't like Rosalind's name. Orlando's like, Jacques asks him, what's your love's name? And Orlando's like, Rosalind. He's like, I don't like her name. And Orlando says, there's no thought of pleasing you when she was christened. And that, I think,
oh, what a great line. I didn't know that line. Yeah. What a great line.
And it to me, it is like the encapsulation of what's wrong with Jacquees. Like, who cares if you like her name? Like, you don't actually get a say. And your problems with the world are not real problems. They're just, I don't like her name.
Right.
And
get over it.
And it isn't, in my opinion, it isn't that Jacquees is a failed character and Shakespeare wanted him to have actually some kind of profound moral insight to offer about the broken nature of the world. I think he's just is made him into this like part of human soul and human society that just can't be pleased, even in the green world.
In that sense, is he meant to be a warning?
Maybe. I don't know. What do you think? What are your thoughts on his kind of role in the play?
I find it difficult. I might align myself with critics who said he's a failed character. I mean, he has some of the most wonderful lines or monologues in the play, but he's so repellent that I might think he's a false character. There's not much of an arc to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's stock, entirely flat the whole time.
Yeah, which is so curious. It's not... the fact that we're saying this about a Shakespearean character like raises my eyebrows because it's so uncommon for even a bit player in Shakespeare to not have a kind of a compelling arc. But for me, Jacquees is one of them. But he does have, and I'm going to ask you to read it, Heidi, as we kind of wrap up here. He does have one of the best known monologues in all of Shakespeare's comedy, All the World's a Stage monologue. I'm going to ask you to read it, Heidi, and then I'm going to tell you what we did. So a couple of weeks ago, I was in Colorado, and I helped direct a Shakespeare showcase of about 10 Shakespeare scenes for the Paideia School in Fort Collins, Colorado. And we used this monologue as the kind of opening piece to kind of set the stage for the other scenes that would follow. So I'd like, Heidi, indulge me a little bit, if you wouldn't mind reading Jacquees' speech, and then I'm going to tell you what we did to stage it, because I think our listeners might enjoy it. It's kind of fun.
Got it. All right. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first the infant, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms, then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like snail unwillingly to school, and then the lover, sighing like furnace with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrows, then a soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard, jealous in honor, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth. And then the justice, in fair round belly with good capon lined, with eyes severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances. And so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his youthful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice turning again toward childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange, eventful history is second childishness in mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans eye, sans taste, sans everything.
It's a beautiful speech, and it's a very Jacquees speech. So the end of the seven acts of man is a return to childishness without teeth, eyes, taste. So instead of one goes to one's grave, you know, having lived the richness of life to take his reward. No, it's a return to childishness and you lose everything. It's a very Jacquees kind of conclusion to the speech.
Mm-hmm.
We had we use this as kind of an opening narration for our Shakespeare showcase. So the audience shows up and our narrator, that was me, was kind of offset. And I read the Seven Ages speech, and we actually staged each of the seven. So at first, the infant mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. So we had an infant who was carried across the stage in the nurse from the Juliet and nurse scene from Romeo and Juliet. So we had the young woman who's going to play the nurse. She carries the infant across. Then we had a little boy dragging a book with his satchel, you know, like looking grumpy. So we staged each of these things, and it was really fun. And it was kind of like a way to sort of introduce the audience to some of the different characters who were going to play different parts. And I loved it. I just loved it. And I've done two or three Shakespeare showcases in which we've used this as kind of a little opening panoply of characters. Is that panoply? I hope that I used that word the right way. If I didn't,
yes, I think you did.
Please correct. Okay, I hope so.
Yeah,
correct me on
totally
Facebook
did.
If I didn't.
That's good. I love that.
Oh, it was so much fun. It was so much fun. Hey, Heidi, we're going to do Act 3 really soon, and we are going to release As You Like It as a batch. We're going to try to release all 5 acts at once, so people can just, instead of watching The Office, binge watching The Office, they can binge listen to Shakespeare's play. I would recommend, as I did last week, there is a good BBC version of As You Like It starring Helen Mirren as Rosalind. It's not the highest production value. It was made in the 80s. And if you've gotten used to HD, you'll be a little bit frustrated at the picture quality. But it's still some of the, you know, just some best English actors in the world are part of the movie. So I would recommend that if listeners would like to see a full production of As You Like It, I would recommend that. There's also a more contemporary version made in the 2000s, which I have not seen, Heidi. I don't know if you have.
I have not, no.
Yeah, so I can't recommend it firsthand. Heidi, any closing thoughts or anything that you're looking forward to in the last 3 acts of our play?
Yeah, I am excited because we're about to get to, we've had a lot of foreshadowing here, a lot of building action leading to how in the world are we going to get our lovers together? How many lovers are going to be brought together?
Right.
In this play. And so stay tuned to Act 3. Definitely puts that in. I'm looking forward to the contemplation from the many disguises that are in this play.
Yeah.
Particularly with Rosalind and Orlando. And I'm just excited because I like this play because it is so lighthearted. Like, it's fun. Mm. And underneath the fun, there's a lot of profound contemplations, but it's not a play with any kind of like heart of darkness to it, you know? And
yeah.
So, which I'm going to put you on the spot, Tim, here,
yeah,
and say, you prefer the heart of darkness in a good Shakespeare. You like the good Shakespearean tragedy.
I do. I think that his dramas, which all are kind of written around the same time, and I'll just enumerate them as best I can. Othello, Hamlet, Macbeth, Lear, Coriolanus. I'm missing one, Heidi. Probably a very famous one. Listeners are like, come on, you're forgetting this one. At least those, and probably one more. I just think those are like mountain peaks in world literature. And I mean, as brutal as the ending of Othello is, as brutal as the ending of King Lear is, I find those the kind of, I find the hard parts of those plays so enriching. I just, they echo in my mind and they echo in my heart more than As You Like It does, more even than Midsummer Night's Dream or Much Ado About Nothing does.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I would say, and you can just tell me I'm wrong on this, Tim. I would say that the contemplations that come up in the comedies are just as profound, but in a very different way. And I think in this, in a very, it feels very different, obviously. And there is something about grief and loss that is, you know, kind of forces a human connection to the transcendent. But I think in the comedies, if you want to find it, you can. And As You Like It, it's there. This idea of the harmonizing influence of love, whether or not Jacques is works as a character or whether he's just kind of a whiny adolescent, it's a good question. And if he is just intended to be whiny, what does that say? And that's the question that I'm always interested in with Jacques. Is if he is not supposed to be, you know, the Malvolio, the Shylock, the Caliban, who's what if he is just a guy who complains?
Right.
And
right.
If that's true, I think there's something to that. That idea that even in the green world, where there is this lighthearted kind of everything's tangled up, but love is a harmonizing force, and yet there's this resistant character who can't or won't enter into that.
Yeah,
and he has a main part in the play.
Yeah,
and particularly right now with the coronavirus thing, when I frankly see that guy everywhere on social media, what if you just resist the opportunity to be redeemed by the green world?
Yeah.
What if you just live and die as Jacques?
Yeah.
That's a sad fate.
Right. You're right. Yeah. I was just thinking, Heidi, that I think part of the reason that the dark dramas are so compelling to me is that the lessons are in the story arcs. So Macbeth, I think we learn something profound about human nature when we see Macbeth get his just desserts at the end of that play, and that's his death. Mm-hmm. I think we learn something about human nature when we see Kent, the servant, like the righteous servant to King Lear, hold steady the entire play and remain faithful to his master, even when his master goes insane. We learn something about the kind of person that we want to be. I think that we do get some of that in the comedies, but I think the wisdom, more of the wisdom, comes actually from the soliloquies and monologues, or kind of like the long exchanges between characters in As You Like It and in the comedies. And I think it's really interesting that Jacques is one of the few characters that holds in Shakespeare's corpus that holds steady the way that somebody like Kent holds steady, but he does not hold steady toward the good. He just holds steady toward his own, toward like nursing his own frustrations, his own cynicisms, his own disappointments with the world.
Right.
And yeah, I don't want to be that guy.
Right.
I don't want to be that guy. I want to be Kent.
Right. Well, and in so many of the comedies, the resistant character has some kind of breaking point opportunity.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
With Malvolio, for example. I know I keep referencing him. And I find the Malvolio storyline like extremely disturbing. And it is this like cruelty directed towards him that I see is very disproportionate to the crime. And that to me haunts the play. And anchors it to a kind of tragedy, even in the midst of the comedy.
Yeah.
And in this play, I think that the tragedy of Jacques is that he doesn't have any trajectory.
Yeah. He's treading water.
Yes. He's just grumpy all the time. And while everybody else is being profoundly changed, and by the influence of this green world, by the order and disorder of love, by their own desires coming in conflict with duty, by their social order, like all of these, every other character experiences some kind of great transformation except for him. And that is why I, even the fact that he remains a stock character throughout is unique.
Yeah, yeah.
And it could be that Shakespeare just didn't get it together to give him, you know, because like just made him a stock character. But I do think it's more than that, or I want to think it's more than that. I want to think that he's kind of the character that says, if you choose to resist being harmonized, you can stay a jerk.
Uh-huh. You'll be quippy at the best, but...
You'll have nothing to say, really.
Right.
And like I
said, you'll just be a walking complaint.
Yeah. And like I said, I know that guy. I know like 50 of those guys. And
yeah.
So that's, you know, especially you see him come out in droves in during an election year and during a national crisis. So.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah.
So don't be Jacques.
Don't be Jacques. If you learn nothing from this episode, don't be Jacques.
Right.
Hey, Heidi, I just want to remind everybody that you, listeners, can join the conversation online on Facebook. The Close Reads Facebook feed is...
hopping.
It's so good. It's so fun. It's like, it really does... Like, people that say they have an online community, I'm always like, what would that look like? That sounds miserable. And then I go on the Close Reads Facebook page and I'm like, oh, this is my online community. I love interacting.
These are my people.
These are my people. We exchange everything from memes to menus, and they're just so fun. And if you have a question for David, for Heidi, for myself about, you know, things that we've recorded online. Like I got a really great question about the nihilism in Crime and Punishment, the kind of like Russian brand of nihilism on the Facebook page. And it was, because we talked about that during our last recording, Heidi.
Uh-huh.
It was really fun to kind of just like delve into that a little bit more. So find us online on Facebook through the Close Reads discussion group. You can also find us on Instagram and at Twitter at Close Reads Pods, P-O-D-S, and via email at closereadspodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget our email newsletter, which you can sign up for at closereads.substack.com. Hey, Heidi, this has been a lot of fun.
Yes, it has. I really do. I'm enjoying this. And it's cool. I'm just sitting here thinking, man, Shakespeare is always relevant.
Always. Always. Hey, listener, thanks for joining us and tune in for Act 3 of As You Like It the next time we record.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.